Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in...
Kia ora to all our listeners. I'm here today with a special guest, writer Deborah Shepherd. Kia ora, Deborah. Thank you for coming in today.
Kia ora, Karen. Thank you.
Deborah is a biographer, oral historian, and teacher of memoir. She's also been a film, television, and media studies lecturer at the University of Auckland. Her publications include Her Life's Work, Conversations with Five New Zealand Women, Between the Lives, Partner in Art, Reframing Women, A History of New Zealand Film, and Giving Yourself to Life, A Journal of Pain, Hope, and Renewal. Her latest book, just out, is The Writing Life, 12 New Zealand Authors, which is the book we're going to be talking about today. It began as a series of oral history interviews for the New Zealand Society of Authors in 2015. And in the intervening years has become, through Deborah's hard work, a collection of crafted conversations with 12 greats of New Zealand writing. I use the term great, as I think you do, Deborah, not in the celebrity sense so common in our zeitgeist, but in the sense of the respect that we feel for them and their work, a respect which urges me to begin with them. Could you tell us a bit about these writers, their place in New Zealand letters, and how you chose them, and so on?
Well, they're a singular generation of elder authors. The oldest was born in 1935, and the youngest in 1941. And they came up out of a cultural vacuum, really. In 1952, Bill Pearson wrote a landmark essay, Fretful Sleepers, from Oxford University, where he was studying. And I've got a quotation from that where he said, "There is an aching need for art in our country. We need an art to expose ourselves to ourselves, explain ourselves to ourselves, see ourselves in a perspective of time and place." At the time that he wrote that, the generation of authors who were the focus of the study, Joy Cowley, Marilyn Duckworth, Tessa Duda, Chris Elth, Patricia Grace, David Hill, Witty Ihamaira, Fiona Kidman, Owen Marshall, Vincent O'Sullivan, Philip Temple, and Albert Wendt were all completing their secondary educations based on a British curriculum that advanced a Eurocentric version of history. What this book does is it follows their emergence from that cultural vacuum through six decades of brilliant hard work to the place they enjoy now, with extensive publication histories that represent the diverse cultural richness of this place and the global recognition for their contributions to literature. So through that period, the first of the authors to publish was Marilyn Duckworth in 1959, and her book was published in the UK, A Gap in the Spectrum, her novel. So she was the first, and then the rest of the authors followed through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. So during that time, it was really a golden era in publishing in New Zealand, where authors could enjoy long and secure associations with one publisher who helped shape their career. Then we get to the 90s and we get the whole meltdown with online publishing, and things have changed dramatically, even for these well-established authors.
It's certainly something that they remark on. I noticed there's a definite optimism, pessimism binary where they're quite pessimistic about the state of publishing at the moment, but optimistic in a more general looking at their personal journeys, which is, of course, what the book is so good at telling us in complete context. And that's also because of the approach as oral history rather than seeking a media interview and getting the sound bites. Could you tell us a little bit about what we mean by oral history and how you got started in the field?
All right, so I just want to say what it is I love about oral history, and I think it's that it's a democratic process, or the most democratic process of information gathering that there is, and it's because it allows the people who have lived through history to narrate their own experiences rather than the scholar interpret on their behalf. It privileges their personal interpretations of the literary history they've contributed to and borne witness to. And the other thing I love about it is its intimacy. It's the product of a dynamic interchange between the narrator and the author. And it's got that capacity to capture a sense of vibrant immediacy. It's history enlivened with vividly told, richly illustrated accounts by the people whose life's work, in this case, involves them daily in the practice of observation, reflection, intellectual analysis, and imagining, and who by aptitude and practice are primed to reach in deep to find their answers. So I was very lucky to be interviewing authors.
12 of them.
12 of them. And that's what's lovely too. You've got 12 voices, 12 personal takes on the same period of history that they were traversing. So you get the stories connecting, and through the defining turning points and events through that era. So it's a wonderful way in to learning about New Zealand's literary history. It's a very accessible way.
And I'm going to pay you a compliment here by saying that in reading the book, it's hard not to notice the skill with which you keep the conversation going and do make sure that it touches on these various aspects, and which leads us back to your experience with oral history and how you got started.
It began in Canterbury. I'd just finished a BA in art history, and I got a summer student job at the what was then the McDougall Art Gallery, and the job was to interview Canterbury painter Bill Sutton. I was 22. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was so lucky to be interviewed by someone who was extremely erudite and just such a gentleman. He really led me through the interview. I didn't really ask him about the life. I didn't have the confidence. It was very much about his work. But then a few years later, I did a feminist studies paper at Canterbury University, and I was introduced to a feminist participatory model of interviewing. And this was a critical learning experience for me. I mean, the great thing about the feminist upsurge of the 70s and 80s was the complete overhaul made by the feminist academics and thinkers of male paradigms of knowledge, male ways of doing things, traditional interviewing models. Some of the examples were anthropology and sociology, where you have this imbalance in the relationship between the scholar going in with set questions, intruding on the subject's privacy, gathering the information, going away, using it to inform academic papers and to advance their own careers, and offering very little to the person, the subject, it was, wasn't it, in return. The feminist model involves the participant in the process. So when my interviews were finished, the transcripts went back to the authors for their feedback and comment. And for me, this, when you are translating something from an oral history into book, because these are crafted conversations, the great thing about this model is that it enriches the content, because I could go back and ask additional questions which had been missed just in the whole, you know, the flow of momentum of the interview, or get them to expand on certain things. And also it means that you can feel confident when that book goes out that we've all worked on this very hard and we're all happy with the result.
And there's been a collaboration, isn't it? The, you know, when you talked about in the old style interview, it was the person was the subject of your interview, and now as a participant, because it's actually you're partnering in the course of the conversation.
There's one other thing I wanted to add here, which is that I've also been involved as a biographer for the Mercy Hospice, and I think that that work has helped me deepen my approach, because what I did for them was I set up a training program, trained the life reviewers, and I wrote a guide to the gentle art of life review. And sitting with dying people, I was able to learn from them what are the questions that really matter towards the end of life. And that then gave me the courage to pose some of those questions to the authors at the end of the interview on aging and adapting to changes in physical capability and those sorts of questions.
Well, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. So it was their thoughts on questions that they were already asking themselves that they wanted to share with you. That's, I hate to use the word beautiful, it seems so trite, but it's a really a compelling insight there. Speaking of insights, I particularly enjoyed the writer's musing on why they write, the famous question, why write? Many different kinds of answers. As I recall, Patricia Grace, Witte, and Albert Wendt are, not surprisingly, the ones who did articulate a common ambition in that they all speak of wanting to tell real stories about people they feel have not been represented as they really are in literature. But all of the authors have something really interesting to say. What was the sense that you got from hearing the answers to this question, why write?
Well, it comes from an inner compulsion to create, to tell stories. I think for the women who are all mothers, there was a need to find an identity for themselves. Patricia Grace says that right at the end of the interview, when she's looking back on the shape of her life, and she didn't begin writing in childhood as many did. It was when she was a teacher and she was raising seven children and she felt the need of an identity for her, something for herself.
Yeah, it was really amazing.
Which fired the writing, yes. Not all of them identified as feminist, but they all had a desire to examine female experience and to supply strong characters who drive the plot. But for people like Fiona Kidman, feminism is one of the major themes underlying all her work. In her first novel, A Breed of Women, published in 1979, which was just such a breakthrough text, because here was a woman talking about all the things that we as young women were struggling with at that time, and it was a courageous
act
looking yes and you know looking at the interior world of women and the frustrations of the gender straitjacket. As you mentioned, Patricia and Witte and Albert, that's right, many of them had such scarring experiences as young people and at school of discrimination. Albert being called Black Sambo by his teacher, who thought it was fine to call him that, but Albert got up and left the classroom and cried. Witte reading a novel, a short story from the Oxford collection of New Zealand short stories in the 1950s, called The Whare by a Pākehā writer, which was so demeaning of Māori, and he threw the book out the window and got caned for it, but it was his first protest act, and at that moment he decided that he would one day write a book that would be put in front of every child in New Zealand classroom, and, you know, about the experience of Māori. And Patricia at school, the nuns at her convent didn't believe that she was could possibly be five because she could read. And the nun said to her, you're seven, you're not five, you're seven. And Patricia said, I thought I was five. And similarly, her maths ability, didn't think that a five-year-old Māori girl could be that clever.
Was Patricia Grace was also the author who told the story about trying to wash away her brownness
with
soap?
Yeah. And I think, and Albert says it well, Alistair Campbell, the poet, said to him, you've got to be better than these discriminators. And he talks about that pressure on Māori Pacific to have to work that much harder than Pākehā. But, you know, these experiences fueled his desire to create much more complex Pacific characters. Complex scenarios, and also to grow the literature, which is something that both Witte and Albert did through their anthologies, many anthologies, giving so many Pacific and Māori writers who now we know of all these writers, but they got their first chance in those anthologies. So Tessa Duda, oh, and that was something else, that the writers for children, so Joy Cowley, Tessa Duda, Patricia Grace and David Hill, when they were growing up, there was really no New Zealand literature to read. So Joy thought that there was therefore something inferior about being Kiwi. And so for all of them, they've been strongly motivated to provide stories set in familiar New Zealand environs with New Zealand Kiwi children at the centre of them. But Tessa said a lovely thing. She said, if I suddenly found that I couldn't or didn't want to write anymore, I'd be thinking, what am I going to do with myself? It's what I do. It's my identity. It's communication. It's sharing. And I thought that was pretty powerful. And Chris Elf said, I write because I can't stop writing. I just have to. I'd even do it if I was never published again.
Yeah, I think Albert Wendt has something like that too. I just can't stop. Mm. It's clearly, there's the... I always tie it also to talent. I always personally feel that when people have such a strong talent, they are not aware of it, despite perhaps not talking to us about it, and that it has to come out somewhere, you know. So, yeah, it's interesting. I always like to ask this question to authors. What surprised you while you were writing your book or preparing your book? Were there things that came out which surprised you?
Yes, well, the previous frame of my books have been feminist, but this book, with its ratio of 7 male to 5 female writers, nudged me to consider the gendered nature of male and female experience and to consider the compromises the men might have had to make in their writing lives, which indeed they all did. I mean, Owen Marshall and David Hill were both secondary school teachers for 20 years before they took the plunge and went full-time, and then were able to write their first novels, but it meant they were in their 50s. They'd been writing short stories, and David had been reviewing and doing some non-fiction projects. But Philip Temple, the same thing. He was editor of The Listener, and in 1972 decided to take his family down to Little Akaloa to live, and he was going to write full-time. His wife wasn't so keen on the idea of that, but he made a promise that he would earn as big an income as he did at The Listener, which he did, and some of that was through writing for Reader's Digest. But he too didn't have the luxury in the time when the children were small and he was the principal provider to work on the longer, you know, imaginative forms, the novel. So that surprised me. Always with the women, I had liked to ask questions about the things that were significant in a woman's life. So there are questions on the experience of childbirth. And is there time for me to read?
Certainly.
From Fiona Kidman, writing about the birth of her daughter, Joanna. I asked her, how did she feel when Joanna was born? Incredible joy. I wanted to be a mother very much, and she was to me the most beautiful child. I couldn't believe that I'd produced such a miracle. She just made me happy. I realised quite soon that she was a child with a difference. She's much darker than Ian, her husband, who is dead now, but Māori. And in Rotorua Hospital, the babies were kept in a separate ward and were brought out at feeding time in a long trolley, a whole lot of babies in a row. And I remember the nurse looking round and saying, I've got a Māori baby left over here. And I said, she's mine. And I saw the eyes flick, just that little look, white girl with Māori baby. And I thought then that it entered into a different sort of contract to what other mothers had, and that was interesting. Yeah.
That's a really good example of something I found so often in reading what these writers were saying to you, that how clear-eyed, how open-eyed and perceptive they were about the things that happened, but how they also managed to see where they were on the personal journey and see a forward movement and almost this, not a serenity is perhaps pushing it too far, but an acknowledgement that this, yes, was a journey that they had traversed. And it's a hard life, the writing life, isn't it?
It is. I mean, how many jobs do you, when you finish a book, it's like you're reinventing. You're starting all over again. It's like going for a job interview at the end of every book, because you've got to find a topic that will interest your publisher, that the number crunchers can see a market for, and then you hope that, that the reading audience will like. I mean, it is incredibly tough, and what these authors show. I mean, I was very interested in, are there attributes that, that mark them out? And I think the tenacity, the discipline, they're just such hard workers. They keep on going. That's another thing about the book that's lovely. It's like a guide to writing. It's got so many tips and words of encouragement for the writers, the readers who are writers, like, for instance, David Hill talking about the publication of his first book, and HarperCollins turned it down, but he said he did what he always does. He sent it straight out to another publisher. So, you know, there's a lot of inspiration to be gained from reading these.
Definitely, and I, not only the inspiration about writing, which I took to heart, but also I found a lot of inspiration about aging, perhaps because of what stage of my life journey I'm at. But I thought that the insights into aging were one of the most remarkable things in the book. This sense of people who had not let things lie because they were too hard and they weren't going to start doing it now. I mean, they were willing to say, someone said, well, I'm not going to write another novel. But at the same time, we're not looking at people closing doors. It's all, I remember Joy Cowley says, the world becomes more beautiful. Mm. Did you find that too? The insights into aging were quite remarkable.
And I think if I'd been interviewing mid-career writers or younger writers, I'm not sure whether I would have got this level of disclosure and preparedness to go deep. I think the thing about this generation is they have all achieved so significantly. So we were recording the story of the life in the latter years of their lives, so there's that looking back with satisfaction. And I think this perhaps made them more relaxed about sharing more intimate things, and they were very generous in their answers. And so I did put the question of mortality to all of them, and it was, sometimes you wonder if you can dare to ask these questions, but always those ones that you dare to ask are the very profound. I even had that with the gendered nature, the asking the men about what it was like becoming fathers, and I wasn't sure whether they'd really get into that, but I was rewarded. There's a beautiful thing from quote here from David Hill when I asked him about what it was like, mm-hmm. the arrival of the children. He said, I remember the heart-shaking experience of holding Pete when he was little and fitted between my hip and the underside of my chin, and the smell of a baby's head. I hadn't expected fatherhood to be so joyous, and the delight I felt in watching him and having him was astonishing.
That's beautifully captured. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the experiences are all so, what's the word I want to put, so diverse, and yet you could, there's a certain sort of almost a life current flowing underneath all of these answers, which probably related to this fact of the how expressive people are who are writers and who have this kind of talent, and probably expressing quite universal emotions in some way, but with such a personal touch.
And don't forget that they've been mining their life experience for all these decades, putting them into their fictions, but also into their non-fiction and into their own memoirs. A number of them have written memoirs.
Yeah, very well said. Mining your own life, yeah. I actually wanted to ask you a bit about life writing and memoir writing, because I know you're a mentor in this area, and it is something which is drawing a lot of interest, especially from people who are at a certain age. Perhaps they've stopped working and they find they have some time and they're very interested in writing their life stories. So there's a funny part where Albert says to you, speaking about his memoir, and he says, behind it, what he's saying is, don't trust me. How about that, about the memoir, trustworthiness of memoirs?
Yes, I think he's getting at that issue of the subjectivity of it and the selectivity of it. And, you know, this goes back to the postmodern debate around objectivity and which was a very worthwhile debate, because it challenges not just life writing, but the scientist's representation of facts and the historian's. They're mediated by many random factors. And, you know, an autobiography written in one's 30s will have very different emphases to one written in one's 80s, when obviously the life experiences along the way and the acquiring of wisdom will add to that memoir. And the same with an interview like this. It's mediated by the questions that we cover. We've covered some aspects, some not. But what I emphasise in my teaching of memoir is that the notion of reaching for one's authentic truth rather than objective truth. You don't make things up in memoir, but you do have to draw on fictionalizing skills to breathe life into your stories, to create mood and character and dialogue and setting, but always with that aim on it being the authentic truth. It's your version of events. You know, other siblings might argue with the childhood experience. It's your version. And readers pick up on authenticity too. And the great thing about memoir as a form is that it does allow you to be selective. You can do a very short memoir like Patti Smith's Just Kids.
One of my favourites.
Yes, or long. You can do Loris Edmond with her three volumes, Janet Frame with her three volumes, Fiona with her two. Witty is at work on three monster volumes. Or it can be an episode in a life, you know, or an adventure. It means that you can avoid the areas that are too painful or too difficult, or that might compromise your own privacy or that of your family's. So it gives you those choices. It's a wonderful form.
Yeah, there's actually, Witty has a thing in his conversation where he talks about this thing that you were saying about fictionalizing, because you do have to fill in, you have to decorate the scene.
Atmosphere.
But what you're telling is the truth. And it's very interesting. He's talking about his novels, so he's actually talking about pure fiction. Before going on too much about Witty, because we are getting close to the end, I wanted to ask you, we'd all like to go on forever about Witty, but I would like to ask you about if you've got a new project coming up in the future already on the horizon.
I've got a few, and there is a book on memoir, which I've made a start on, which I'd quite like to go back to and finish. I'm going to be doing a writer's residency it's a relatively new residency at Karikari in what was formerly the Dorothy Butler homestead, and now it's an artist and writer's residence. And I'm doing that with John McDermott, who was the photographer for the Writing Life project. I mean, those photographs, those black and white photographs, really add a very deep, beautiful additional dimension to the book. And so John and I will be out there sharing the residency, and it's a lovely opportunity because we're allowed to do whatever we want. We've got 3 months in that incredibly inspiring setting in the bush and by the sea to write and to photograph. So I'm planning on writing a nature journal while I'm there, because that's another thing I love to do, is to journal. And John will be photographing, and we'll just see whether a joint collaboration comes out of that or whether it's just an opportunity to revel in doing what we love doing and not having to worry about paying the bills for 3 months.
That sounds like a dream. That's wonderful. Well, well deserved after the hard work. It would have been years you put into this book, wasn't it?
3 years.
3 years. So I can't recommend it enough. It's called The Writing Life. Please go out and get it from your library or your bookshop. And thank you so much, Deborah, for coming in. It was lovely chatting with you.
Kia ora, thank you.
Kia ora, everyone. Ka kite anō. This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day, every day.
Paris.